All right, now, you see, Pam, you want me to tell you initially my name is Henry Camero, Henry Jules Camero, and I was born in New York City in what is, what was then referred to as the French District. It was in prime part of town, also known as Hell's Kitchen. I was born in 1923, May 2nd, 1923, so I have the frightening experience coming up that I'm going to be all of 60 in another 6 months. My schooling was primarily in the public schools of New York, and they veered from the city into Long Island when I was about 8 or 9. My mother died when I was about 11 or 12, and I was shipped off to Asheville, North Carolina with an uncle who raised me. And I had a sort of a checkered school attendance after that. I don't suggest to you that I didn't attend school, it's just that I went to so many different schools because they owned restaurants in Asheville, North Carolina and Palm Beach, Florida, which were seasonally operated at that time. So we used to go back and forth from Asheville in the summer, which was delightful, to Palm Beach in the winter, which was also delightful. And then eventually the war came, we went to the wars, World War number two. After that, like all good soldiers, we made sure we experienced what we thought we might be missing. And so we traveled in California, all over the United States. And eventually, just on a lark, decided to go back to school. Went to a community college in North Carolina and Florida, and eventually ended up at George Washington University, where I went to law school. I only got my LLB, which I guess is now known as a JD. Also picked up my master's, and even went back to American University, which incidentally beat Georgetown last night by 1 point basketball, and took quite a few accounting courses. And then when it was a decision-making time, what to do and where to go, now that I had a big law degree, I initially took a job as a law clerk for a private firm in Washington, D.C., then law clerk for a U.S. District Judge, James R. Kirkland. As was customary, the law clerk would go to his judge at the end of his tenure and say, "What do you think I ought to do?" He would say, "What can I do to help you?" More instances than not, the law clerks would be given positions such as assistant U.S. attorneys in the District of Columbia, where I law clerked, or would pick an area and the judges would try to help them through the Department of Justice. I picked Alaska because as I roamed through the halls of Congress, I came across an office that said delegate from the territory of Alaska, and by chance had the opportunity to talk to Bob Bartlett, who was then a delegate, later became a U.S. Senator, and he so enthused me about the wonders and the marvels of Alaska that I began looking into it, reading the newspapers, reading books, talking to people, and eventually made a decision, and with the help of the judge that I worked for, came to Alaska, then a territory, as an assistant U.S. attorney. Is that a broad kickoff for you?
Why did you decide to go to law school?
Well, for several reasons. One is I had a very good friend of mine who I had known during high school days, a country boy from Asheville, North Carolina, very bright. And he and I ended up in the paratroops during World War II. And he decided to go to law school and suggested I come along, and I really thought that was far beyond my grasp. But he convinced me that we ought to try it, and so I did. found out that although my first year I was not the best student, that my last year I was able to make high grades.
Mm-hmm. Did your friend go to law school?
Yes, he went to law school. He's practicing in Phoenix, Arizona. John C. Mull, M-U-L-L.
Why didn't you go to Phoenix, Arizona?
Well, initially, J.C. went to Oregon, and interestingly enough, when my first wife decided Alaska was just too much for her, we did settle down in Oregon, not too far from J.C. He was in Salem, and I was in Eugene, Oregon, for a period of time. That would have been from about 60, 65, 66 until about 70, about 3 or 4 years.
What law firm did you clerk with in
D.C.? Joseph Turco. It was a small law firm, T-U-R-C-O. He had himself, another attorney, and a couple of associates, and the whole concept that I had initially thought about was wanting to stay with a small firm. I didn't want to get buried in a large firm. Plus, I wanted to work on my master's and also do some more in the field of accounting. I had great visions of being a marvelous tax lawyer at about that stage in my career development. And he made it very easy for me to be able to work with him and attend school. After I became a law clerk, I did finish out my master's and got it in 1954, an LLM with an accentuation in taxation, and they changed the code. And when I thought of Alaska, I realized that realistically you weren't going to be a specialist in the state of Alaska, in the territory of Alaska at that time. And well, I thought, well, it would never hurt me in the business world, and decided that I'd just pursue being an attorney in Alaska, that I knew at that stage had to be broader in the subject matters that I'd be interested in.
Had Kirkland ever been to Alaska? Had the judge do
no.
Or did he know anybody in Alaska?
No, he was a good Irishman who knew nothing of the outside world beyond Washington, D.C. and Ireland. That was his entire scope of an environment as far as he was concerned. Interest, he had nothing beyond. In fact, when I suggested Alaska to him, he was horrified at first. He thought, could you consider Alaska? You've got a future here.
Did Bob Bartlett give you people to get in touch with in Alaska?
He did. He didn't mention lawyers so much as he mentioned communities where he thought the practice of law would be very rewarding. And he referred me to Cordova, fascinatingly enough, where he knew a banker. The banker's name escapes me now. He was well known at the time. He told me about Anchorage and Juneau, and I think in passing mentioned Fairbanks. He never discouraged me from any particular city, but I think he accentuated on the positive side the communities he thought that I might be interested in. And knowing at that time that I was interested more in eventually going with a small type of firm and practicing in a small situation rather than a larger one, I think. He thought Cordova at that time was going to grow. He foresaw the fishing industry and the tourist industry and things of that sort. It's the one time that I'm sort of glad I didn't follow his advice. Other than that, I think he was a very fine man and he had some wonderful thoughts and encouraging words for any young person that wanted to come to Alaska. Funniest thing about Bob Bartlett, as I recall, is that Bob told me to make sure that I frequented the country club when I went to Juneau. And the country club in the East had only one meaning, and that is a beautiful golf course with, you know, clubhouse, what have you. Country club in Juneau meant simply a restaurant, a steakhouse out on the roadway a bit. And I didn't realize that until I got to Juneau, that there was really no country club up there. but I think I don't think I was misled as to the general nature of Juno before I went there.
What did he tell you about the general nature of Juno?
Well, there was a lot of publications by the Department of Interior, because Alaska was a territory, and I had a whole array of pictures of Juno. In fact, I'm quite sure that I wrote to the people, different people in Juno, like the mayor and attorney general. You know, just wrote a series of letters. And then when I finally knew I was coming up, the gentleman who was my main communication initially was Pat Gilmore, who was an attorney down in Ketchikan. Have you interviewed yet, Pat? Pat is a good Irishman and a very delightful person, and I talked to Pat on the phone. He is the one that hired me. The Department of Justice authorized my coming to Alaska, and at that time there was a change of administrations about to take place. Eisenhower was going to take office. The judge I worked for in Washington, D.C. was a good Republican, and although they knew I was a registered Democrat, they still sent me up, because I don't think they had that many applicants to go up to Alaska at the time. And Pat Gilmore hired me on the phone. I remember that was a latter part of the year. And, we were expecting to go up within something like 2 weeks and remain packed for some time. And there was no response, and all of a sudden I got a little inkling from the Department of Justice that there may be a little problem in Alaska, and they said they wanted me to call a fellow named James Fitzgerald. So I called James Fitzgerald, and he advised me that there had been a dramatic change of the circumstances in the 1st Division. What had happened was Mr. Emory Tobin, who was leading the foray and was the foreman of the grand jury, had apparently indicted, or caused the grand jury to indict a series of persons in Ketchikan, including the chief of police, the assistant chief of police, and many prostitutes and madams and others. And Jim Fitzgerald advised me that Pat Gilmore had been removed by Judge Folter because the foreman and some of the grand jury complained that he was interfering with their processes. And as a result, Jim explained to me that he was the acting U.S. attorney, and things were in a bit of a turmoil, and he was saying, I want to be very candid with you, I think it's a bit of a problem area, so you perhaps want to look very carefully as to whether you and your wife and family want to come up. So we evaluated that, and I think it took us all of 10 seconds and said, absolutely. We were on our way just a few short days later. Arrived in the great city of Juno with Jim Fitzgerald at the airport and a flurry of snow flakes coming down, an old Connie airplane saying, landing. The airport was just a little, I think it was about a 2 or 3 room type of building, very small. But I was enthralled, and the people on the plane that came up were very interesting. Even though you read a lot, may anticipate what you're going to see, you can never truly create the scene exactly as it was. And I think I was thrilled when I saw it. I really, the first time I saw Juno, I fell in love with it. And even with all the bad feelings and expressions by others about Juno, I don't think I ever quite lost the feeling for Juno. I think some of the people can be a little asinine at times, but there's a few of those everywhere. Most of the people, I think, in Juno are very fine people, and were at the time.
Who was the U.S. attorney? Fitzgerald?
Pat Gilmore was the U.S. attorney, but he had been removed, and therefore Fitzgerald was the acting U.S. attorney.
So did you work for Fitzgerald, or did you work for...
I worked for Fitzgerald, and then Fitzgerald... I say this in a friendly manner. Cowardly ran out on us to Anchorage and took a transfer up to Anchorage. And Ted Munson, then an attorney in Juneau, who had been with Judge Folter for some time as a law clerk, pardon me, became the acting U.S. attorney in Jim Fitzgerald's stead. Ted Munson. Ted Munson is a young man from the East who had come up to law clerk for Judge Folter. I've lost his address. I know he worked as a corporate counsel in the lower 48 for one of the larger corporations. I think Jim Fitzgerald would know. And so Ted was the acting U.S. attorney and I was assistant U.S. attorney. And they put on another young man down the road too. But he left Alaska. His name escapes me now. His name was Ted something also. And then there was another young man that came in later on called Donald Connors. And Donald Connors had suffered polio and had to be in a wheelchair most of the time. So there were three of us, and we had to go to Ketchikan, and we became enmeshed in a series of trials, incidental to the indictments that had come down. I shouldn't say Jim left us. He did try a few cases, but there were quite a few others to be tried. I think Jim had a problem because the community was so small in both Juneau and Ketchikan that he was friendly with a lot of the police officers who were indicted, in particular the chief and assistant chief. That made it a little difficult for him.
So did you, what side were you on?
Prosecuting? Gilmore was never prosecuted. Gilmore was never indicted. He was simply removed. A new administration came in. Pat had been put in by the Democrats as a result. It was normal to simply change judges and make perfect change attorneys, U.S. attorneys. And so he was briefly reinstated and almost immediately he left office, and then the Republicans appointed their man, who I think was Ted Munson. I think Ted did stay for some period of time. I only remained with the U.S. Attorney's Office for about a year, and then I shifted over into the Territorial Attorney General's Office, which at that time consisted of J. Gerald Williams.
What year did you come out?
February 1954.
And you were in Anchorage for part of that year?
No.
Not at all?
I never left the Juneau, the first district. I was in Juneau and Ketchikan. Mm-hmm. Occasionally over to Sitka to try a case, occasionally to Yakutat where there was potential claim or charge to be filed. A lot of fishing violations at that time, and some occasionally assault and battery charges, especially in the summer months when there's a lot of activity, and a few more dollars because of the fishing season.
Did you hold your cases in front of Judge Folter?
Most all of the cases were in front of Judge Folter, although there was also an occasion when judge from Anchorage used to come down, Walter Hodge. Right, Walter Hodge used to come down, but the bulk of them were with him before Judge Folter.
What was Judge Folter like?
He was a mixture of people. Gave the impression that Judge Folter was a hanging judge. And interestingly enough, I think he was very law and order oriented. On the other hand, I thought his sentencing practices were less stringent than some of the U.S. district judges whom I had observed in Washington, D.C. Folter gave an air of being very formalistic. You might even think of a Prussian soldier when you think of Folter. But actually, when he was off the bench, he loved to walk, and he loved to have someone walk with him. And he would walk from one end of the community to the other end of the community. He loved to talk while he was walking. And I did do that on different occasions with him. We were sort of like an entourage when we went to Ketchikan. There would be the U.S. attorneys, assistant U.S. attorneys, court clerk, the magistrate would meet with us down there, Judge Folter, and frequently the defense attorneys would join us, and we might go to lunch together, we might go to dinner together, any number of things we might do. And surprisingly enough, although he didn't drink, and at least I never saw him drink, and the rumor was he didn't drink, although I'd heard that he did take a glass of wine occasionally with dinner, he would get up and I remember him at an Elks dinner, dance one time, out on that dance floor probably half the night, just full of vim and vinegar. I know he died on June 4th, 25 years ago, 26 years ago, because on the day he died, my first daughter was born. And do you know how he died?
Yeah. Oh, bear hunting.
He was in the middle of a boat, a rowboat. They had been bear hunting, and Mark Jensen was with him. Mark Jensen is not an attorney, but Mark Jensen is still in Juneau Douglas area, I believe. And Mark tells it, they were apparently seeing if they could get any fish out of a particular lake, and he noticed George Folter out in the middle of the lake in the boat sort of leaning over. And they called at George, and there was no response, and apparently he had had a heart attack and was in that sitting position sort of leaning over as if he might be working on putting a worm on some bait, on a fish hook, looking down into the boat. Finally got him in. He had died of a heart attack. There was no salvaging. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for letting me go off tape here a few minutes to take a call. And while we were off tape, I may have stated something that either I stated it wrong or I gave a wrong impression. Fitzgerald left Juneau and came to Anchorage about 1955, and he came up here as an assistant U.S. attorney, and I don't really know what all of Jim's reasons were. I think he foresaw Anchorage as being a community that would develop. I think it gave you a freedom in Anchorage versus Juneau, which, as you know, is at that time particularly, it was more closed in, and you didn't have the opportunity of just taking off in a car and going 100, 200 miles away. I think he also had the influence of the fact that assistant U.S. attorneys used to work close with the police, either in investigation work, incidental to a case, or just by the very nature of the offices, the respective offices, you would see them quite a bit. And when two police officers, and I think there may have even been more, were indicted down in Ketchikan and were subject to being prosecuted, I think this may have created a bit of an awkward situation for him also. I think also the fact that he had been working for Pat Gilmore, and Pat had been removed by the judge, may have made him feel comfortable in the sense of his former, the man who hired him was removed, and it may have been, he felt it would be better if he just started with him up here. He's an outstanding attorney and was an outstanding prosecutor, so there was nothing in the sense of his office and his, the duties of his office. I never left Juneau for Anchorage at any time, if I gave that impression in my earlier comments.
Let me ask you, how often did the court go down to Ketchikan with Bolza and all the U.S. attorneys who were there, U.S. attorneys who were there? How often did they go?
Well, as often as needed, and that turned out to be for several weeks and months in the 1955-56 period. Juneau was the base where George Folter had his home and held court as a general rule. But he was, and all the judges were amenable to getting a call and being there the next morning for a plea and maybe staying a day or two. When we had this series of trials on these indictments, we were down there. It seems to me it was forever, but it was really more like a couple of months, as I recall. Because we would slip off on a weekend sometime and come back and let our family know we were still alive and well, you know, talk to them.
Was everybody prosecuted?
Did we get a conviction on everybody? The chief of police pled guilty to a lesser charge. The assistant chief of police, I believe, did the same. We had a series of cases, and I would say that of the many, many indictments, we probably got convictions on 85 to 90% of them. A lot of them pled guilty to. In fact, I don't know of many that I didn't get a conviction on off the top of my head. I know at one time I had a string of about 8 straight convictions and then I'm jury trials, and then I don't know what happened. In fact, the newspaper, the Ketchikan Daily News at the time, one of the newspapers, wrote an article, and the article was an unusual article in a way. It chided Ted Munson, who was from New York, Henry Camero, who was from New York, and this other gentleman who was also from the East. And the net effect of the thrust of the editorial was that we were bringing the mores of the East Coast into Ketchikan, Alaska, and it wasn't needed. And the other newspaper, on the other hand, the following day, lauded us for the outstanding job we were doing and the convictions we were getting, etc. And two newspapers were obviously on a different side of the fence about that matter. But it was a little bit of family chiding here and there, but I never felt too offended by it. And I remember Bob Baker, he may still be down in Ketchikan. Bob Baker, Bill Baker? Anyhow, Baker, I remember, was the editor at the time. And even though he was scolding us and telling us that we were being too heavy-handed in bringing these cases, he also recognized that we inherited them. I think some of the people felt that prostitution shouldn't have been attacked as it was, you know. I mean, there were some people who, as you probably may be aware, felt that, and this was pure hearsay, that many of the upstanding citizens of Ketchikan were married to young ladies who had gotten involved in trade. And many of them, I think, felt that prostitution controlled helped the economy, gave the fishermen an opportunity to relax after their hard fishing season. And it just wasn't denounced by everybody. The way the chief of police and the assistant chief of police got involved was they were trying to control it, I think, more than anything else. One of them did get involved with the girl. Maybe two of them did. In any event, know, this was territorial days, and the feeling was that the girls would be there to make sure that they had medical examinations periodically and make sure that they weren't going to spread some terrible disease among these poor guests at their homes. So the issue of whether or not prostitution should stay or be done away with was a hot controversy in the community. In fact, the city council members, I understand, before my time, were the subject of debate among the grand jury members as to whether they should be indicted or not, because they had impliedly condoned it and acquiesced in it. Well, my case, it wasn't. What happened was Tom Stewart was an assistant attorney general under Jerry Williams and was leaving that post, and Ed Mertes was the other assistant, and Ed and I had become friends. And so he urged me to come over and apply for the vacancy that was being created.
Why didn't you go into private practice or into a law firm in general?
Thought about it. In fact, Mike Monaco talked to me about it, an old-time attorney, and I really was giving it some thought, and I just felt that maybe I should have a little more experience and a little more familiarity with Alaska. You know, you weigh options, and that was one of the options. A lot of them were doing, there was sort of a division. Faulkner Banfield, Boutchieva law firm, represented what might be described as the conservative element, fishing industry, canned salmon industry, the banks. Mike Monaco and his firm, Robinson, Monaco, and Eastall, represented some of the competitor banks and maybe some of the other fish processing companies, but more times than not, they were on the more liberal side, and Banfield was the more conservative side. Mike represented a lot of fishermen. Mike Monaco, he's still alive. Have you interviewed him? Is a delightful person. He was a little Irishman who was very capable and very competent. He was very sure that he would win his cases in the fishing charges that were leveled here and there, especially in Sitka. Have you been told about his Sitka escapades?
No.
Well, there was a commissioner over there who was a nice fellow, Frank Robinson? That may not be quite the name, but anyhow, Frank was a commissioner, and he was a law and order man because George Folter was a law and order man, and the influence carried over. And when anybody broke the law, Frank felt it was very important that that be acknowledged and recognized. And Mike Monaco knew that when there was a charge brought against a fisherman over there, that all he had to do was, number one, get anybody on the jury, because of the six members on the jury, there'd be at least one fisherman, or the wife of a fisherman, or the brother of a fisherman. And that fellow would hold fast and make it a hung jury. And no matter how good your case was, he was quite sure that was going to happen. The second thing he'd do is he would literally bait the commissioner. If the commissioner said, "Sit down, Mr. Monaco," he'd stand up. If the commissioner said, "Mr. Monaco, I don't think you ought to ask that question," he'd ask it again. And the net effect of it, Frank would get red-faced and outraged, and he'd want to hold him in contempt, and he'd scream at him, and Mike would all of a sudden become the sweet gentleman, and, "Oh, Your Honor, I'm sorry if I've offended Your Honor." And Frank would be beyond control at that point, and the net effect of it was the jury would be a little upset that he'd be so uncontrollable, and Mike would tell you before he even went over, "You're not going to win this one." And you'd be very frustrated because in Sitka, you had a real problem. He wasn't quite that successful over in Juneau, but in Sitka he was. In Juneau, there was a real fine man, I don't know if he's still there, who was the magistrate, district judge. Neither. Frank was not a lawyer, nor was the... There were very few lawyers at that time who were just among the magistrates and those that act in the capacity of district judges. I don't have his name here for me, but he was... Gray. Yeah, Magistrate Gray. And they owned the Juneau Hotel, the Alaska Juneau Hotel, a small hotel, just a block from the courthouse. And he was a very, very warm person. And I'd say 40 to 50% of the U.S. attorneys prosecuting practices up here at the time involved juveniles. It was nothing great, but you know, bicycles would be taken for a joyride and candy bars would be missing at the store. Then there were some more serious crimes, but you had a tough time getting a youngster and doing much more than giving him a tongue lashing with Magistrate Gray. He almost felt like he was going to put a fatherly arm around the boy, and the young man would be let out into the community again. And more times than not, he was probably right, because youngsters in a small environment like that would pick up and correct their ways.
Were there so many juvenile cases because of the nature of the court that it was a lower court and probably still had to
Yes, the magistrate had the jurisdiction over the misdemeanors, so, and also over the juveniles. And kids get restless in the winter months and just go out and do foolish things. More serious crimes involving juveniles would be the statutory rape type of cases, in which the 25-year-old guy would take 14, 15-year-old youngster. Sometimes they get married. She was rather young, and then there were other occasions when the older guys and the younger girls, and this was a problem to some people too. You know, they would feel that, well, the girl was physically older than she looked and so forth, but the law was fairly clear, and so you...
As
I recall, there was a provision of the law at the time that it was a sort of a choice. If it was more than a statutory rape case, you know, and force was before the Judge Folter. But if it was just simply an age difference, then you went usually in front of Gray. And what didn't mean that there were times when Gray felt the age disparity was such that he would impose a strict sentence. Strict sentence for him might be half the maximum, you know, because he had the most with a year that he could give. But there was quite a bit of that, especially, it seemed that the native persons had a different culture, and so they weren't as offended by sometimes the age discrepancy. Sort of thing. You examine the Tionic case that occurred some years back with Stan McCutcheon. Pardon? No, where a man over there, I think, was charged with rape, as I recall, McCord. And the question was whether or not the cultural law would apply versus the Alaska law. And the cultural law applied. It's in the books. I know. It's, I think it went. I think it was even appealed, but I think they upheld it. So the cultural, you know, aspects and influences were a little different on occasion. And this happened frequently. You had to give that consideration. I met some rather fine native persons, the Parachoviches, Roy and Frank Parachovich, two people that explained a great deal to me about the native persons and how you had to be considered about their, some of their beliefs and their approaches to matters. And it wasn't being done just to escape the white man's law. It was simply that this is what had been agreed to by the tribe members.
What was the Attorney General's office like? What was it like working for Gabriel Williams, and what were your
duties? J. Gerald Williams is a complex man. He's a brilliant man. He was a school teacher, and he has a steel trap mind. And he was a very capable fellow. But by his own admission, he also thoroughly enjoyed traveling, thoroughly enjoyed a party, and I think still does. And the criticism that poor Jerry faced was that he was out of the office more than he was in the office. And as a result, for the most part, Ed Murdy's, the senior assistant, was in charge. And we more or less ran the office. There was a great controversy during this period of time. The governor was appointed by the President of the United States, and his name was Heintzelman, I believe. And he was a quiet, minor Republican, and he was guided a great deal by Paul Robeson. On the other hand, J. Gerald Williams was elected by the people and had a lot of independence. And as Attorney General, he felt he, having been an elected official, had more of a pulse of the people than the appointee would have from Washington, D.C. And so there was instances when the governor would ask for an opinion, and as to the legality of a piece of legislation, such as like the Unemployment Security Compensation Bill, or the Employment Security Compensation Bill, the ESC Bill. And I know there were instances when he would ask an opinion, and he would be the governor would be very unhappy with the opinion as to the legality or the propriety of a particular type of provision in the legislation that was passed. And the controversies were open. If you read, and you had an opportunity to read the newspapers back in those 55, 56 days, you'd see the crossfire that took place between the two men. What else can I tell you about the offer? The bar exam was very much like the bar exam I had taken back in Washington, D.C. and passed. It was an essay question, and so a great deal rested on the individual interpretation of the answers. As I recall, Warren Taylor, Jerry Williams, and one other person were the bar graders. And I think the run-of-the-mill person who took the exam didn't feel it was much different than if he had taken an exam elsewhere. There were exceptions, and I don't know if you've already been involved in those. Mildred Herman, who was a delightful woman down in Juneau, who was an attorney and who was also on the statehood committee, had a son who's, surprisingly enough, went to the same law school you and I did, George Washington. And I think he went to California first. I believe he passed that exam down there. At least he went to some other state, passed, and then came to Alaska and did not pass the exam. And Mildred and others, in fact, I think he filed a lawsuit on it. And Mildred and others felt very strongly that Jerry had simply taken a dislike to her or to him or son, and as a result had pretty much kept him out of the bar. I wasn't there when he, apparently he took the bar exam two or three times, and I wasn't there the first time or two. I never had anything to do with the grading of the exam, so I couldn't, you know, tell you. I felt bad because I liked Herman and we were friends. I didn't think it was proper for me to try to influence Jerry, so I never talked to him about the bar exams at any time. I don't know that Ed Murdy's ever did, but I didn't. I just kind of wanted to stay away from it. I know the same type of criticism was leveled on with respect to Tom Fink. But again, I never saw a bar exam. I never helped grade a bar exam. You know, I just had nothing to do with it, and that was there. I helped grade a bar exam years later when I was out of the Attorney General's office and I was a member of the grading committee. But to that point in time, while Jerry was grading them, I had nothing to do with it. But Jerry was a strong person in a lot of ways, and I loved Jerry, and I thought highly of Jerry, but I, you know, Jerry was politic, and well, I can't say on the merits who was right and who was wrong. Realizing the accusation came, I think there was another party that made the accusation too, but I know Russ Arnett. So there was about three that were making separate accusations in that same vein. Defend himself adequately. Have you already taken his stand?
Sure. What do you say he was politic?
Why do I say he was politic? Jerry was well known to be politic. He would. It still is today. It was the way you did things. You know, I have no doubt in my mind that, just like they do in the Congress and probably 49 other states in our state, legislators will get together and they'll say, I'm not going to go for your bill, I'm not going to go for your particular program. However, if you'll go for mine, I'll go what I'm interested in, I'll go for part of what you're interested in. And all the agency heads at the time would vie for appropriations for their office. And, you know, as a result, Jerry was politic in there getting his appropriations, and I'm sure he figured some bargaining chits here and there on how he'd do it. I know one thing that they tried to do, was to stop Jerry from traveling, and I think they were going to take out a part of the budget for traveling, and somehow or other he got it back in, and you know, I wasn't privy to it, but I remember seeing the budget after it, and even though I read the newspapers and heard the great criticism about Jerry traveling, I recognized it, and that was going to all be taken out, and Jerry still got it back in. What I did was I sort of insulated myself from some of that. I wanted, in fact, that's one of the reasons why I left Jerry, because I really, I thought the criticism was too heavy. I thought that I'd just soon get in private practice. I just want to practice law. I ran for office once. I was a city council member down in Juneau, and that took so much time and effort and such a hullabaloo that my attitude was, practice law is exciting. It's fun. You know, it's a challenge. You were here a few minutes ago when a case came in. That's a challenge. So from my point of view, I wanted to get fairly involved in the practice of law and not have to get involved in these side issues. I thought they were unnecessary.
When did you quit the Attorney General's office?
What happened was in 1959, when we became a state, Wendell Kay and Moore, Dick Gruhl, came to see me and asked me if I would become the executive director of the Legislative Council. They wanted me to help in the transition. And I was agreed, but I wanted to make sure Jerry had enough time to get another person to take my place. And I remember being there when Dick said to Jerry, "We want to take him next month." And Jerry was saying, it wasn't too far before the legislature was about to convene I think it was going to be the first state legislature. And as a result, I shifted into that position and stayed there for about a year, 18 months.
What happened between territorial time, the statehood time, and the Attorney General, the switchover?
Well, what happened was the Attorney General's office was elected under the territorial days status. The Alaska Constitutional Convention drew up a proposed constitution and under the Tennessee plan, they elected two senators and a representative and went back there and said to Washington, "Here we are. We have our constitution, we have our two senators, we have our member for the House of Representatives. Open the door to us." And the two senators were Senator Greening and Senator Bartlett, and Ralph Rivers was the representative. And this was the Tennessee planters, and they agitated for statehood, and statehood eventually, as you know, came about. Well, under the Constitution, of course, it would be the strong governor, so there'd be no elected officials. So when statehood took place, and the new governor was elected, and he appointed his attorney general, it eliminated the post Jerry Williams had fulfilled. Jerry ran for governor, as I recall, the first time, and didn't make it. So that eliminated that slot.
He didn't stay on any longer after they eliminated the slot.
Jerry knew that there were political enemies out there that would have none of Jerry. In fact, Tom Stewart was a very strong, I think, opponent of Jerry Williams. He's the one that led the foray with Vic Fisher to have a non-elected attorney general. There was an interesting balance, and if you look at the Constitutional Convention signatories, there were a lot of liberals, Tom Stewart, Vic Fisher, et al., and then there were a lot of conservatives, Vic Rivers, Bob McNeely, I don't know if Stepovich was in the group at all, And then there were a lot of people in between, middle-of-the-roaders. But I felt that the liberals had more of a voice in putting the Constitutional Convention and the ultimate Constitution that they produced than the conservatives did, even though we had a lot of conservatives up here. The strong government concept, the Missouri plan to elect judges, that was relatively new and untried, and the intellectuals were advocating it. They've made mistakes with it. Mm-hmm. They've made mistakes in the Missouri plan, for example. We only have seven persons on a judicial council nominating judges. That worries me. They can play politics. I would have preferred to have seen a larger number of judicial council members so that we would have gotten a better group of judges. And games were played. Games were played very clearly, because when you take a look at, who got elected where, for example, I can't tell you which one, where it happened, but, you know, there were instances when judicial counsel is supposed to send two names up to the governor, two or more. They would send, the judicial counsel, through their politics, would send a person they really wanted and then get somebody they had never thought the governor would elect. But he did. And that happened. That happened more times than not, you see. So,
like when?
Oh, I think it happened, God love his soul, I think it happened with Hubert A. Gilbert. He's retired now, and I think he turned out to be a hell of a lot better judge than people thought.
Who was he against?
I can't remember now, but I remember there were some fairly good names that got put into the arena. And plaintiff's bar became very strong about that time, led by Bob Parrish and Bailey out of Ketchikan. And they were trying to pack the court. And I think to some extent they did. You know? Bob Parrish and I were on the opposite end of a lot of cases. I love him. I hate him. I respect him. He was a tough person to be on that opposite side, and I think he and some of the other fellows got together, and I think they did put a lot of liberal judges in. You know? Certainly, when you look at some of the judges that we had, J. Rabinowitz was thought of as being a liberal. Hugh Gilbert was thought of as being a liberal. I don't think they accomplished everything they wanted to. And some things happened that they couldn't get around. Well, for example, Walter Walsh. Egan liked Walsh and wanted Walsh to be a judge. So Walsh became a judge, and he had never practiced privately. He had always been with a government agency. And Walter was a nice fellow, but, you know, he hadn't had the practical experience out there. I think some of the people thought Jim Vonderheide was a liberal. I think Jim's always been a fairly level person, great sense of humor. Now, in the third district, interestingly enough, you know, Ralph Moody and Ed Davis got in. They were labeled conservatives. Jim was sort of a middle of the roader. He showed liberal aspects, sides to him. He showed some more conservative. Just Jim Fitzgerald, that's now U.S. District Judge. We're very good friends. Hep was supposed to be a middle-of-the-roader, but he turned out to be more conservative down the road. Of course, you realize that you can't publish this for some time. I have to appear in front of these fellows still. Okay, what else can I answer for you?
The court bar fight.
Ah. I know.
When did you leave the court
bar fight? I left Juneau in 59, early, I think it's 59, early 60,
as
I recall.
How long were you on the legislative council?
About 18 months to 2 years. Mm-hmm. I went through two sessions, as I recall.
Did you work with people like Warren Taylor and Bob McNeely and George
McMahon? Oh, yeah.
What were they like?
Well, Bob McNeely became my law partner later on. It was McNeely, Murdies, and Camaro. I thought McNeely was one of the sweetest guys I've ever known. He had a drinking problem. And Bob knew more ways to secret his drinking than anybody else I've ever known. I could almost do a shakedown on Bob on an airplane before he went into the restroom and be convinced he had nothing on him, and by God, he'd come out. And I could smell alcohol, and I could never figure out how he did it. I loved him, though. He was the kind of a guy that every once in a while, he'd work for weeks, no problem. Then all of a sudden, he'd go off the wagon, and I'd find him, and I'd take him to the hospital. And his sisters loved him over there, and they'd help him, and in a couple days he'd be out again. The sad part about Bob McNeely that I really resented was the fact that Bob, and everybody knew it, had this drinking problem, and I think there were those who took advantage of him. And Bob became the president of the Senate down in Juneau. After I left, this happened the year I left, or after I left, and I'm not unaware of the story about how they plied him with alcohol. And I know those who did ply him with alcohol, the net effect of it was, though, as Alex Miller once told me, even under the influence, he was probably a hell of a lot better president of the Senate than 90% of them. He was a capable guy. I thought one of the most delightful stories about him was I was down in Springfield, Oregon, practicing law with two fellows, that both of whom were now dead, but I got a call one day, and it was a case of Drew Pearson, who was Jack Anderson's predecessor, was suing Fairbanks Daily News Miner up in Fairbanks, and would I represent the News Miner, because the attorney they had, Dan Riviera, had a conflict in that he had defended Pearson in the past years. And, my God, here it came on short notice. I think I only had 3 weeks to prepare. And so I was down in Springfield, and I went to the University of Oregon, and I remembered I hired two people, and two students, and we pulled out every article we could find that Drew Pearson had ever written or made any statements. And anyhow, we went up to Fairbanks, and Bob McNeely was going to be the local co-counsel. And the big issue was whether or not it was libelous for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner to have referred to Drew Pearson as the garbage man of the Fourth Estate. And first witness was Drew Pearson. And there was also Senator Wayne Morse from Oregon and Roosevelt, the congressman. And we had Senator Stevens and Senator Bartlett, and quite a bit of notoriety. In any event, the case, Bob Parrish is on the other side, and case went on for several weeks, and finally we came to the time when we had to go into the final arguments, and a lot of evidence had come out that had reflected that Mr. Pearson was a little indifferent to how he slandered libel people himself and the things he had done to hurt people. And I argued that we broke up our argument in front of the, I think it was just a court, I don't think it was a jury. We broke up our argument so that I would take something like 20 minutes, and Bob McNeely said he only needed 5 minutes, and then, that was something like the breakup. And so I argued all these great points.
What about Warren Taylor?
Warren Taylor? I knew Warren Taylor as a legislator and as a lawyer. Mm-hmm. Warren Taylor had a lot of stories. Have you interviewed Warren up in the ranks?
Yeah, his son.
His son. Did Warren die?
Yeah.
Okay. Warren Taylor was a crusty old bird. And first story I ever heard about Warren, and I don't know if it was true, was that supposedly Warren was assigned to defend the criminal case. And on the day of the trial, he went in, and there was a lot of these defendants brought in, and it was a first-degree murder case that he was defending. As he walked into the courtroom, supposedly Warren looked around and said, "Which one is the defendant?" I hope that never happened, but that was kind of the story that one would talk about Warren. Warren was a legislator, and I think Warren is the one that's responsible for this big preempt statute that's now causing a lot of controversy. You got the right to preempt one judge without cause. As I recall, Warren is the one that put that in. Warren probably typified, you know, the last vestige of the territorial attorneys. He was tough, and he'd get up there, and he didn't care what he'd say, and he'd just go at you tooth and nail, both attorney and client. But then when it was all over, he'd laugh with you, he'd say, let's go have a drink, or let's go sit down and talk about, you know, different things. And that was typical of a lot of them, and he was just as obvious in that regard as anybody. I remember trying a case against Warren. In fact, there was about three attorneys in that case. And the subject matter of the case was that my clients had diverted a stream so that the stream went down the roadway and took away this man's property when the spring thaw occurred, and as a result they were suing my client for diverting the stream. And the thing that was so unusual about the case was that Warren was trying it, and all of a sudden another lawyer came into the picture. In fact, a third lawyer eventually came into the picture, and Warren took the stand on behalf of his client, and he tried to qualify himself as an expert on watershed matters and how water came down the hillside and the effect it would have. And every time his lawyer asked a question, I objected, and Judge Hepp sustained me, so that the net effect of it was, after he had tried for about 20 minutes, 30 minutes to get these questions in, why Warren Taylor had said nothing. So I could tell, they figured, well, if Henry asks one question, he'll open it up and Warren will go at it. So I decided I wouldn't ask any questions, but I thought I'd have fun with Warren. And I said to Warren, "Well, Mr. Taylor, I know you're a very capable lawyer and astute lawyer, and I'm really just going to ask you one question. Have you ever been convicted of a crime?" And Hep got to hysterics and called a recess because he thought that was the funniest thing that happened. And Warren just got incensed. "What kind of a question is that?" That's not the question he wanted. He wanted a question that would, in essence, let him testify on all of the things that we wouldn't let him testify on direct examination. But even after that trial, Warren just laughed with me and thought that was the funniest thing that I would ask him, that dumb question. He says, "I was just hoping you asked me one question. I knew what he wanted me to do." But that was Warren. He was crusty. He was nasty. Didn't care if he took on the judge, the attorney, or the witness. His own client, I think, sometimes. And yet, the guy had a real big heart. You go over to Warren and say, "I want you to do me a favor." He'd try to do it. He might not remember to do it sometimes, but I always felt he was in good faith and wanted to do it. And he did it.
Can you compare the atmosphere of the Fairbanks Bar with the Juno Bar and Anchorage Bar?
when I left Juneau and went to Fairbanks, I can give you that comparison right away. I can't do too much with Anchorage. The Anchorage bar was very structured, very almost formal.
This is the Juneau bar.
The Juneau bar was very structured and almost very formal. It had the influence of Bert Faulkner, who was in his 60s or 70s, but still very lively, and Norman Banfield. I've thought of Norman as always being so very proper, business-oriented, and Bob Boochiever, and everybody. Just when I first got there, it just seemed to me that even though they were good old Alaskans, everything was very much in the caste system. And you were a newcomer, and watch you a while to see whether or not you were going to be accepted. And then when they accepted you, it was a nice environment. Fairbanks was far different. I mean, we had a bar group that used to meet in this restaurant just about every day for lunch, and it was very informal. And I think you probably read some of the minutes of the Fairbanks bar, and I think that's a carryover from yesteryear. The guys were just relaxed and easy. They were too different. I mean, you could have put the Juneau bar and set them in, I think, any community in the lower 48, and they would have been a good cross-section of attorneys and well-respected and highly thought of. I suspect the Fairbanks bar you could have put in Wyoming somewhere, maybe, some smaller communities. But they were sort of rough and rowdy. But I loved them. I just think they were really great guys, too.
Who were the deans of the bar when you went up to Fairbanks?
Parrish was a big influence up there. He was a personal injury lawyer, and I think he was a major influence. Charles Clasby, it had been Collins and Clasby, were major influences, and Mary Alice Miller came into that firm later on. Collins got to the point where he went down to Sitka, I guess, and home for the age, which always surprised me because he was doing a lot of insurance business, and I thought he was a wealthy attorney, and obviously he wasn't. Bill Bogus, I think, was a highly respected attorney up there, although Bill had a testy way about him that offended a lot of people. Charlie Cole certainly became prominent and years helped Charlie, because Charlie may sound like he's sort of surly, but he's really a fairly, I think of him as a very good lawyer and a very nice guy, and I think I'm a personal friend. Even Parrish, who I fought with, and I mean fought to the point that no holds barred, as I said a little earlier, I loved him, I hated him, but I respected him. And when I saw him a few years ago up in Alyeska, I couldn't help but have some warm feelings of the guy. Had a drink or two. Those were the people. I'm probably missing some. Hep was in private practice the first time I got up there and became a judge. There was a lot of resentment toward McNeely, Murdy's, and Camerill at first because our firm did get large up there before I left. We had five, and that was large. There's no other five-man firm up there that I call. Grace Scheibel joined us, and I had a George Volt there for a while, and we had others. We were friends. Ed is a politician, Ed Birdie, so he naturally made friends. He made them easier than I did. I was more competitive. I was more involved in the combat, so I was sort of more competitive with some of them. But I was fun.
Was Jillian Hurley still up there
when you... He was there, but only for about 6 months, 6 months to a year. Jillian Hurley was... he had his friends and his group. I know another fellow that was kind of a fellow that we enjoyed, too. I see his face, and I don't see his name. A thin, used to go up to Nome a lot.
Fred Crane.
Fred was a very bright person. Mm-hmm. Now, Fred and I became close. A little incident occurred once in which we sort of... I think, helped Fred a bit. And so he kind of took me into his fold from that point on. Oh, he had a little bout. And we just sort of, a little drinking bout, and we just sort of happened to be around at the time. And we just sort of became a little friend. No, there was no big deal, you know. But I became very fond of him, and heard a lot of stories about Fred Crane that were very interesting. And I know the native people loved him. You know, he was married to one, I guess, for a while, lived with him a great deal. And yet, he was sensible. When you really knew Fred Crane, and if he had a case, and you said, "How should we do this, Fred?" He was usually very practical. There were certain lawyers in the state at that time that you could almost hand your file to. I don't think John Diamond reached what I anticipated he would reach in his capabilities as a Supreme Court justice. I urged John to run, urged him very strongly, and I'm probably one of the most disappointed persons in John Diamond. John is honest, sincere, a man of religion, a beautiful person. But as a judge, I was very disappointed. He should have probably received more practical exposure to the real world. But John Diamond was one that I wouldn't hesitate to have given a file to and say, "John, what do you think of this file? Your client's on the other side." You know? And that was the same with, I think, people like Bob Annis, Bob Boochiever, I think Mike Monaco. I think I could have done that with Fred Crane easy. You know, there were lawyers like that. There were other lawyers. You got one free bite with me, and then you didn't get a free bite after that. Fred Crane was the type of person that probably, in different circumstances, he'd have been far more wealthier and on top of things if he wanted it. But as it was, I think he enjoyed his life. He lived in Nome for a while, in Barrow for a while.
Did he work with anybody in Fairbanks?
Yes, he did. Who was it that he worked with for a while?
Was it with Warren Taylor?
Yes, Warren Taylor. Right, that's who it was. It was with Warren Taylor. He and Warren worked together for a period of time. And I thought Fred Crane saved Warren Taylor's skin a couple times because Fred was relatively quick to come in and see a problem and I think handle the problem faster than Warren might. Mm-hmm. You asked me about George McNabb.
Yeah.
Did you know much about, have you found out much about George? George was a little banty rooster. Mm-hmm. Good attorney, but didn't really stick down with it too much. And decided he was going to be a legislator, and I think he wanted to be governor someday. He had an ego. God, as big as a mountain. And he knew the political ways, and he pulled some cuties. I know they tell me the story that when he was running, and they got him a lot of pamphlets to take to some small village where there were quite a few voters, and I couldn't even tell you which village it is now. And I understand that he had a date that night, and what he did was, they tell me, he asked a guy to open the door of the private plane they were in, and he threw the pamphlets out while they were flying and went back. That's the way he did his campaigning at that time. George was ruthless. I really think he was ruthless. And a politician, you know, he probably, and I like George, he probably did it on the basis of they were ruthless, and I'll show them a game and do it a little heavier. And he was able. He was able
were
to do it.
Were they all ruthless? Were they more ruthless than Ashton?
The legislators? Mm-hmm. No, there were some legislators that were, I think, I don't think they were any different today. I think it's just a case that if you had George McNabb around today, he'd be able to stand toe to toe with any of them down there, whether it was Bill Ray, Jay Catula, Bob Ziegler. You know, he'd know how to do it. On the other hand, there were a lot of other, there were legislators who I think are very, I think they were very much motivated by what was good for the people. I think some of them were too starry-eyed. I don't think they had a good feel of the real world. I always think Vic Fisher is a good friend of mine as being, you know, very starry-eyed. I think he started to get a little more realistic in the last few years, but I mean, there was a time when Vic is an intellectual with a doctorate's degree who truly wanted to do what he thought was best for the people, but he was uncompromising. Well, you can't do that in the legislature. I've seen it. You know, if everybody played that rule, that'd be fine, but if they're not playing that rule, then you've got to recognize where you're coming from. Well, McNabb was a genius in the sense of, I think he knew how to bargain and he knew how to work things. He knew how to block things, too. So he was fairly capable at it. There's T.N. Gore, too. Did you ever run across his name? And he was from Tennessee, and he got into a couple of problems, apparently. Although I thought T.N. Gore was a good lawyer. He married a young lady who is the wife now of Caskey, isn't it? The judge down in Sitka?
Yeah.
Pretty sure. I think it's Caskey or McCaskey who was up in Fairbanks for a short time. And
was Kraske?
Dwayne Kraske.
Yeah,
T.N. Gore's wife, I think, eventually married Dwayne Kraske. I think T.N. Gore went back to Tennessee, and I think he was some way related to Senator Gore from Tennessee. And he had less hair than I had, if you can imagine. Big, tall boy, blonde, and very good in the court. Good in the court.
I wonder if the court bar fight, were you up in Fairbanks at the beginning of that?
No, it fermented, began fermenting, I think, while I was here, but it happened more after I left. Nesbitt Diamond and Harry Ahrens obviously attempted to, and I think in good faith, attempted to correct what they thought were some of the ills of the bar. You probably know the background on Nesbitt. Probably know the background on each one of the individuals that were up there. I think Nesbitt truly was motivated by high ideals. I mean, he'd had his problems as a practicing lawyer. You know, he had a drinking problem early, but he was a good lawyer, came about, and I think the feeling was that Nesbitt was, I think many people thought that maybe Nesbitt would be a captive, and that wasn't his nature. I mean, once he got up there, you know, he exercised what he thought was his prerogatives.
Who would he be captive of?
People who helped get him in. Stan McCutcheon and, you know, that group of fellows.
That's
Bob Parrish, I think, was his. I think Bob Parrish thought Nesbitt, who had been a plaintiff's lawyer and would be very accommodating, you know, and very... You understand what, when I say a captive, it doesn't mean that they're going to prostitute themselves. What it means is that the philosophy would be as your philosophy. A defense attorney would love to see a former defense attorney be a judge because he feels that might help his cause. That was Bob Boutcheva's situation. But Bob Boutcheva really carried a middle of the road. I mean, there were times when Bob was liberal, times when he was conservative, and... I don't think that always happens, and that's what happened with Nesbitt. I think Nesbitt went up in the eyes of a lot of plaintiff's attorneys as unquestionably going to be helping the plaintiff's bar. And I think Nesbitt's attitude was a little different. I think his attitude was, first of all, there are some problems at the bar that I want corrected. I think there are some attorneys in the bar that I think are dishonest. You know, I think that's what he was. So I believe his motives were good, and I think Harry Aaron's were, because I know I met with Harry down in Oregon and sat down and chit-chatted with him, and he was looking, when he was defeated, he was groping around on what to do. And one of his thoughts was that he might teach in Oregon, teach law, one of the schools there. And, you know, Harry's attitude was, we were taking over the judiciary's prerogatives of controlling the bar to make it a better bar. That seemed to me where they were trying to go. Mm-hmm. Well, they may have used, you know, the confrontation might have gotten to unfortunate proportions, which it did. But the motivations were good. Have you ever talked to Nesbitt?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's still alive, you know.
Oh, yeah. I want to talk to him.
I hope you do.
When did you go down to Oregon?
63, I believe.
So you weren't at any of the bar conventions where they were trying to muster support for it?
No. But obviously, the test of strength came through whether or not the bar could convince the public that the Supreme Court was an error, and therefore the Supreme Court should be told they're an error. And the way to let them know it is to defeat Harry Aaron. And Harry Aaron was just a sweet guy.
Was it a united front? Was the bar united?
I think, as I recall, and I did come up periodically, you know, and I'd get a little bit of insight. But it seemed to be that the vociferous ones made the most noise and, of course, got all the newspaper publicity. And unfortunately, I think the responses by Nesbitt were not in keeping with, in hindsight I can probably say this, with the judiciary and the image that you would have of the judiciary.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, some of the new lawyers coming up were hesitant to go either way, so they held back. The old lawyers, the old guard lawyers, were really pushing against Nesbitt.
Mm-hmm.
And there were not that many in between who were prepared to stand up. I think Hughes would have been the one that they might have expected to stand up, and I don't think he did. Any dissent, or Thorsness, you know, some of those fellows just sort of remained passive. That's the impression I received.
Who were the ones who really led the fight?
Oh, I think it was Boney, I think, and wasn't it Doug Talbert? Didn't I think Talbert I heard a lot, and McCutcheon. There we go. You know, it had been Nesbitt and McCutcheon.
Yeah.
I think that's who it was. I'm saying this from.
Those are all Anchorage people. Were there any people who were really involved with
the government? Well, Parrish was anti-Nesbitt at about that time, because Nesbitt hadn't necessarily shown the propensities of being a liberal judge. And I know that when Aaron's left and they put in Rabinowitz, you know, I know the feeling was that, well, Rabinowitz was a good liberal and he would stand up to Nesbitt. And so for a while there, Diamond was sort of in the hot seat.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Does he talk much about this? Have you talked to him? Says very little, huh?
Yeah. He doesn't go into it in any depth.
I think the unfortunate part was that there appears to me that there wasn't a sufficient amount of meetings by the justices. They should have been meeting a great deal more and understanding the problem at hand and trying to resolve it, you know. I think there should have been more meetings, and there should have been a request that the bar have a more representative committee and try to work it out. I think it got to the point where the confrontations were such that they were almost, it seemed nobody could back off. No, and that was a dangerous situation, unfortunately. And that's the impression I received as I was hearing about it.
Why did you go down to Oregon?
My wife, my first wife. I was in Fairbanks, and we had 13 days of 66 degrees below zero, and she's a very sweet person, and God, we had three young children. You know, they wanted to go out, and they wanted to come in, they wanted to go out, and they wanted to come in, and heat broke down, and we had to get that resolved, and you know, we had horses, and I came home one night, and she'd had three martinis, and I knew something was wrong, but she's not a drinker. She would have a drink occasionally. And so it was pretty much obvious that I had to accommodate her. Wasn't easy, but we figured we'd better do it. So we looked, cast around, and we decided Oregon looked like a nice place.
Did you have any trouble starting the practice?
No, we met a fellow down there named Jack Lively, who Ed Murdy's knew through the Junior Chamber of Commerce, and we hit it off well, and we went into practice with that firm, and actually it became a rather large firm, well, larger, for Springfield. And it was Sanders, Lively, and Camaro, and I missed Alaska. In fact, my problem was I was coming up here to do a lot of cases, and I got a real tear there, and
Sanders was not Bill Sanders, or
no,
Sanders, no,
entirely different Sanders, even spelt differently. Yeah.
Is that S-A-U-N-D-E-R-S?
Yeah, S-A-U-N-D-E-R-S, and I think his is, and it was just a nice practice down there, beautiful country. It was just that I was traveling a lot to Alaska, and then I had a client that wanted me to be in the house counsel for them, and 50% of the time, and so we, and they did a lot of Alaska work, so we sort of drifted into, pretty soon I found myself back up here so much of the time. And then we had a compromise going for a while. I was general counsel for Alaska Airlines. And then I ultimately made a decision I wanted to come back up. And that unfortunately caused some domestic problems. So we separated and then got a divorce, and then I eventually came back up and remarried.
So. Back to Fairbanks?
No, Anchorage. No, Fairbanks, I wouldn't do that again to a woman. I think Fairbanks, to most women, is a, some women have no problem with it, but to most women, that's a tough place to live, you know, especially if you have children. There are other things I didn't realize then. I think all lawyers should get out of here in the winter for at least a week.